Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hey, in case you missed it, Donald J. Trump, the 45th president of the United States, the Republican frontrunner for president in 2024, called into the Stuart Varney Show on Fox Business yesterday. And as I wrote in my newsletter this morning, please stop me if you've heard this before, reminded us what a thoroughgoing clusterfuck his mind is. I mean, it's just, I don't know how else to describe it. We're joined this morning by A.B. Stoddard, associate editor and columnist at Real Clear Politics. Good morning, by the way, A.B.
Good morning.
You know, in part, it's like same old, same old. But given the fact that the Republican Party might just want to give him back the nuclear codes, it's worth just, you know, taking a moment to remember, you know, just how ignorant and reckless this guy is. And it was on thorough display yesterday. And Stuart Varney is trying, I would say, somewhat heroically, trying to get a coherent answer from Trump about what he would do in Ukraine. And he's asking him, so what should we do? Should we send jets? Should we send, you know, MiG jets to help the Ukrainian Air Force? What would you do, Mr. President? And he was unable to get anything like a coherent answer from Donald Trump. This is what he got.
What should he do?
Well, it's very late. The cards are laid and the cards are out. And he's got a bad hand. He's given himself a very bad hand. He had a very strong hand before it all started, the strongest. And it should have never started. Would have never, ever started if I were president. I can tell you that with 100% certainty. This is horrible. This is a human tragedy, what's going on. He's now going with a very weak hand, and he is not somebody that really mixes it up. He sits there, and everyone tells him what to do and what they're doing, and he doesn't mix it up. He doesn't. Look, it's very sad to watch. I've watched it. I've seen it. And these other countries are taking over, and they're leading, and we're supposed to be the one that's leading, and they're taking advantage of us like they have. Even our allies, they take advantage of us on NATO, they take advantage of us on just about everything they can, and in particular on trade. I mean, on top of everything else, they take advantage of us on trade, and they're really telling him what they want to do, not what we want to do. So it's pretty sad to watch.
There's this discussion about whether we should send jets, MiG jets, to help the Ukrainian right. Air Force. Would you send in that kind of help?
Well, maybe even more.
So, again, you would think that somebody who'd spent 4 years as commander-in-chief would be able to string together some coherent sentences about this, especially when we're dealing with the possibility of a nuclear confrontation. And what do you think? Your thoughts?
I think it is depressing, as it always is. Person, man, TV, camera, Covfefe, you know, his mind is so disturbing. And we know from those 4 years that he didn't read any briefings and he didn't listen to any briefings. He interrupted people and started talking about Mika Brzezinski's face or something. So it's not a surprise, but it's still alarming and depressing. And the word salad soup that went on in that interview was so telling, because he doesn't have an answer right. to what he would be doing. So he enjoys sort of sounding like a crazy man. He talks about 40-year-old planes, and he says he sent in the javelins glowingly. He always has some good adverbs.
Yeah, right.
But he says everything would have been fine, you know, if he was president. And Biden's so sad. He's so hapless. And he likes to talk about oil. But it was so clear a few weeks ago, Charlie, when he spoke to one of those, I don't know, knuckle dragger podcasters. Remember, he started talking about right. windmills, and everyone made fun of him.
Yeah, you know, I'd forgotten about that. I was thinking about that. I should have put that in my newsletter this morning. But that was a perfect. He was also asked the question, "What would you do?" And instead of coming up with anything like a rational answer, he goes off on about windmills, right?
Because he doesn't have one, and it's all intentional. I really believe it's intentional. He doesn't have the answer. So he goes, I'm going to go into my favorite kooky filibuster and talk about our capabilities if I was president. Now, his new line is that Putin is a tragedy and Putin's killing thousands and thousands and thousands yeah. of people. But he doesn't have the answer. And so he does his default.
More. It'll just be more.
Kooky crap, which he did for years when people would ask him what his favorite book was or his favorite psalm was or, you know, what he thought of David Duke. And so he does this, the windmill thing. I watched it And it was hard, but I suspected that's what it was. And I found it to be entirely intentional. And it certainly did frustrate Varney, which is interesting because it's a Fox News program. It's Fox Business Channel. But with him repeatedly saying throughout the interview, let me press you again. I mean, he knows Trump doesn't have an answer, but he was pushing for one, which I thought was interesting.
Right, because he figured you would have one. So, you know, Trump, you know, standard answer is more, bigger, better, whatever. So I have to give credit here to George Conway, who pointed out, you know, since we're talking about, we can get to the recklessness in a moment, but the incredible inveterate ignorance of the man. And he tweeted out this excerpt from the New York Times that Mr. Trump did not seem to know, for example, that Britain was a nuclear power. And once asked if Finland was a part of Russia, and this is quoting from John Bolton, his national security advisor, Bolton writes, the president never tired of assailing allied leaders and came closer to withdrawing the United States from NATO than previously known. He said it would be cool to invade Venezuela. So, yeah, by all means, let's give him back the nuclear codes. Let's give him the nuclear codes. Let's make him commander in chief. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, and I do think that people need to be, they need to be confronted with this. I mean, we can't just, people saying, you know, we're going to move on past this whole talk about the past and election of 2020, and we're going to talk about the future and what the Republican Party can do for voters because Democrats are socialists. I mean, this is so consequential and terrifying, and it has to be put into distinct language. Do you believe this man could right now confront Vladimir Putin and the barbarism and evil of this invasion and the theft of a nation, and he can't answer to this day what he would do? And do you believe that he would be up to it again? And should he have the nuclear codes? It doesn't matter if he never becomes the nominee. They should be forced to say today he cannot become the nominee.
Yeah. And so far as I can tell, even though the Republican Party seems to be going in a very different direction on Vladimir Putin, no one's broken with him. Nobody has said that. And I mean, exactly. I just think that's interesting. And it mainly it's because it's the, and we've gotten used to this, kind of this shrug, like, you know, who needs the hassle? I mean, right. I could say it, but then the flying monkeys would be released. So instead, I'm going to, I'll vote to support Ukraine. I will vote to sanction Putin, but I'm going to kind of pretend that Donald Trump is not Donald Trump and that he might not become president. It's that sort of denial, that sense that, well, somebody else should take this on or something will happen, something will come along, but I'm not going to be the one to do it, right? So
that's what they always have done. It's the wish casting. I'm going to wish this away for another day. Just like you said, something will come along. And in the years when he was president, it was much harder and they would duck and bob and weave and they didn't see the tweets and they haven't been on the internet in 3 weeks. And they don't know what anyone's talking about. But now that he's out of power, it's we're talking about the present here and the future and the danger of the Democrats and the weak Biden administration. And they refuse to take it on, knowing that it's a serious question whether or not he becomes the nominee, number one. But number two, it will help him not become the nominee if more people would be explicit about how unfit, you know, he is. And this current crop of 2024 wannabes, you know, they all are hoping for a health event or an indictment. That's what they all want to make him go away. But it seems like only Ron DeSantis is trying to sort of creep out and talk about Trump, you know, slightly critically and move past him. Mike Pence can't even bring himself to do that, even though he's technically running, right? And technically has separated himself from Trump on Russia and January 6th or whatever.
Well, that's
he's still,
critical,
even he won't come out and say, and, you know, to say there's no room in our party for Putin apologists, to me, is still a cop-out because he can't say his name.
Yes. There's no room for Putin apologists purely abstractly, right? If it's just imagine if there was someone out there, no place in the party for him, but I'm not saying any names. I'm not pointing any fingers. So what does Ron DeSantis say? You said that Ron DeSantis is saying some things critical. I apparently have missed this.
No. So he had, again, a very intentional planted moment where he went on the Ruthless podcast hosted by Josh Holmes and a few other Republicans where he was interviewed and was critical of Trump's handling of the pandemic. I never imagined there would be lockdowns. And he really was kind of laying some blame at the foot of Trump, the outbreak of the pandemic and how it was handled. And it's the only separation, but it's significant. I mean, he's trying to do it bit by bit.
But that's kind of depressing that he's distinguishing himself from Trump by implying that Trump was too aggressive in fighting the pandemic, which is so you're actually to the whatever the right or whatever our political standards are these days. So let's talk about some of the news today. Yesterday was the first day of the hearings, the confirmation hearings for KBJ. I'm going to call her KBJ now since it's, you know, since Ruth Bader Ginsburg was RBG, right? So she'll be KBJ. Your thoughts on how it went? It's very clear to me that the confirmation process, obviously, is just no longer about judicial qualifications like it used to be. And nobody's really even pretending anymore. And because now it's all about payback and ideology. And you could just feel the way there's still the hangover from the Kavanaugh hearings, really, heavy in that room.
Oh, it wasn't even subtle. It was more than a hangover. It was retaliation. There was some, just those Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz moments about Kavanaugh and how they won't be torturing this nominee the way the Democrats did. And I believe that much of the way that the left handled the Kavanaugh whole process was uncalled for and not pretty. But they made it very clear. No voter is listening to any talk, Charlie, first of all, about dark money from either party. Really, I'm sorry. It's time to mute the remote when that happens, right? Yeah. But confirmation process is now overtly a vessel to grab some momentary attention and the spotlight and to campaign and fundraise and get on Fox. And because Cotton, Cruz, and Holly are all running for president and they sit on that committee and they're competing with each other, it's even more exaggerated and they have to escalate more because they have to outshine each other. Whereas if just one of them was on the committee, it'd be a different story. And then Lindsey Graham certainly likes a lot of attention. So he needs to be as sort of nasty and obnoxious, not as they are, but more than his other colleagues and more than he would have been in the past when he supported Democratic nominees and stuff. So I just find it, it's so performative and it's so unsubtle. I just find it so obnoxious, especially in the face of, the first day is kind of, it should be her day. They're going to cut into her starting today with these grueling hours of questioning and it's going to be, high stakes and substantive stuff. And you can be really obnoxious then, but her opening statement was just, look, it was just such a great, glorious moment for all of us. And it just seems just sort of extra special, ugly, I think, that they would soil the first day with all that 2024 stuff. But they had to. Yeah.
And it is 2024 stuff. And it was performative by Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz. But let's just set them aside for a moment. I wish it could be permanent. But Marsha Blackburn.
Yes, I forgot to add her.
Why is Marsha Blackburn on the Judiciary Committee? I watch her and it just, words fail.
I think that some people think that she thinks that she might be trying to run for president.
Oh my God.
It's not well founded, but she has changed her hairdo, which is a tell. I don't know. She's sort of upping her exposure and she wanted to make it onto the news for asking if it was her personal hidden agenda to incorporate critical
her
race
own hidden agenda. Well, if it's your hidden agenda, you don't admit it, right? I mean, that's the thing about hidden agendas. They're cunning. They're cunning plans. You don't go, yes, I have a cunning hidden plan to do X, Y, or Z. So I look at a number of people on, in the Senate, and there are people whose brains are broken. I think like Ron Johnson. There's people whose backbone is broken. People like Ted Cruz. Josh Hawley knows exactly what he's doing. But Marsha Blackburn, I don't think she had a brain to break. I mean, it's just like, wow, that's just bad. It's just, it is one of those moments. So listen, you've been watching this for a long time. I was thinking this morning about, you know, what has happened now to the judicial confirmation process. And it has been a very, very, very long time coming. I mean, I wrote yesterday, you know, that there was once a time, you know, when you had these bipartisan votes, Ruth Bader Ginsburg confirmed 96-3, Antonin Scalia 98-0, Stephen Breyer 87-9. Even the more recent Obama appointees got more than 60 votes. Now, of course, it's strict party line vote. But this is not something that has been is new. I certainly remember the hearings for Robert Bork. People need to understand, you know, how for many conservatives, the Borking of Robert Bork, the really very personal attacks on him was really a formative moment for a lot of conservatives. And there's a lot of baggage there. So is there some turning point in your mind for how we got here? Because I guess the point I'm making is that it's very clear that people now see the court as very much a partisan red versus blue thing, as opposed to, you know, getting the best and the brightest names there. And it is, you know, it's our team versus your team. And it really is a reflection of how the legitimacy of the court as an independent judicial body has been undermined, if not completely destroyed, that the damage that, you know, institutionalists had feared has actually already happened. You know, what was the turning point? When did it go from being a, hey, let's get the best and the brightest person, you know, and everyone will vote for him, to this point where no Democrat's going to vote for a Republican nominee, virtually no Democrat, and no Republican or virtually no Republican will vote for a nominee by a Democratic president?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint because, as you say, Bork was the beginning significantly of the kind of personal, brutal campaign to stop a confirmation. And the Thomas hearings were the most dramatic thing that we've faced. I mean, it was a soap opera. It was Dynasty. It was Dallas. It was crazy. I'm dating myself with my TV references, but I know you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure. Well,
the young kids won't get it, but we'll just tell them that it was as dramatic as it gets. And you had in Anita Hill this really compelling victim. It was just hideous on so many levels. And so you look at what you mentioned, bipartisan votes during the Obama years.
Yeah.
And I guess you could say that Mitch McConnell's decision to block Merrick Garland broke the brains of the Democrats permanently, I would say. The outrage of that is really turned it into a zero-sum thing, I believe, on the side of the left. So This confirmation will not tilt the balance of the court. The Republicans are sitting on an embarrassment of riches on a 6-3 court. You know, most of them dreamed and hoped they would see in their lifetime. And I do think that you combine that with the fact that she's a Black woman and the first, they're going to play nice. And we don't obviously, if there was a big Kavanaugh-like late surprise or a Thomas level surprise, it would change everything. So I would take back what I'm saying, but it looks like this is going to be nothing for her. They're going to play nice. They're going to play to the cameras about critical race theory and crime and some QAnon flirtation and all that to rev up their Snapchat fundraising. But I really don't believe that they're going to do anything terrible to block this. What they want to do is obviously just slow any juice it can get the Democrats. But I think that I would point to, because Kagan and Sotomayor received Republican votes, and those were bipartisan votes, and I guess Manchin supported Gorsuch. Am I right?
Gorsuch got 54 votes.
I think we're really looking at Merrick Garland, and then afterwards there was just maybe a few Democratic votes. I would have to look back. I think Manchin did support Gorsuch. Yeah.
I
don't think Joe Donnelly did, and he was in a tough race. Anyway, it was over in the Trump administration, and things will never be the same again.
Well, again, that's true. And I just think you go back in history, though. One of the other things, and I think that conservative legal commentators will point this out, is that this is also a product of what they would describe as the activist judiciary. And the fact is that the Supreme Court has become way more powerful and important in our in culture wars and our political wars than I think that it ought to be. It's too consequential. All of our major issues now are settled not in Congress, but by the court. And I think that that's become kind of the default setting. The court will decide the future of abortion. The court will decide the future of affirmative action. The court will decide the future of, you know, the EPA's policies on climate change. And so it's really become, you know, for all the marbles for the court, that those that five justices now determine the fate of almost all of the issues. And while we have this completely dysfunctional congressional world and the gridlock of our politics, the power has been ceded to this court. And so the stakes are higher and higher. And there is the perception that the court rules on an ideological agenda rather than on a legal agenda. And as a result of that, these things do become pitched battles. And will continue to be pitched battles, which I think is unfortunate, because then what you've done is you have completely redone your expectation of what you're looking for in a judge, and you've completely redrawn your expectation of what you're looking for in a court. And I know that people like Justice Roberts had been really concerned about this, about the credibility of the court, about the about the integrity of the court, and the legitimacy of the court. I think this is a losing fight right now, and I think we're seeing it played out in the way it becomes red versus blue.
You make such a powerful point. The Congress ceded the by shutting down as an institution and barely functioning. It refuses to share power. It doesn't guard its power anymore, and it has ceded its power, and that has, as you've pointed out, made this so much more high stakes and so much more consequential, and they have become this kind of decisive body for our biggest debates. What's interesting, though, and I have to just note, is that the Democrats, the activist left, might be, you know, super energized at moments, but as a party, the Democrats did not make this a huge issue with their voters, either in 2016 or 2020. The last election, I kept asking, when are they going to talk about the courts? And they don't. They don't tell their voters what this means. And so, you know, the fact that conservatives or the general right, the Federal Society, you know, the best minds on the right have been organizing, fundraising, planning, recruiting, grooming to take over the courts for years in an effective way, is the Democrats' fault.
That's really interesting, because I can't remember a time when I did not think of the courts as being decisive. I can remember back in the 1980s thinking that the most important thing about a presidential election was who they might put on a court. And so I think that, again, that's been shaped over a long, long period of time. And you're absolutely right that the right has very much stolen a march on the left. So can I just throw out some just random historical references, which by the way, will date me. I'm guessing that you are too young to even remember this stuff, because I remember the most intense confirmation fight that was sort of, you know, formative for me, was watching back in 1970, Harold Carswell and Clement Haynsworth. Do you remember them?
I was watching them on CNN.
So Nixon made two consecutive appointments to the high court, both of which were rejected. Carswell was rejected. No, actually, I got it wrong here. So Clement Haynsworth was rejected, I think, for a variety of things about his qualifications. I think some of his comments on race, I'm kind of remember. So he was voted down 55-45, which was kind of a shock at the time, because that hadn't happened in a very long time. And then Nixon had a second crack at it, and he nominates Harold Carswell. And everyone's sort of assuming, well, he's going to get the second one, since they went through all of the heavy lifting of stopping the first one. And Harold Carswell was basically a mediocrity, and he was also voted down 51-45. And I remember just being fascinated by this, that you had two consecutive nominees voted down. I don't know the last time that happened. And then, so Nixon has a third crack at it, and he names Harry Blackmun, who goes on to be the author of Roe versus Wade. And Harry Blackmun was confirmed on a vote of 94-0.
Wow.
So it's just, it's a strange thing because, of course, you know, I asked you for what the turning point would be. I keep coming back to the way that Roe versus Wade really made judicial politics just a fixture in our culture wars for the last 50 years. And there was no going back. The once the court stepped in and said that there was this right to an abortion, that launched the pro-life movement, that launched so many other of these ships that we've been talking about.
Right, but and it makes my point that the that growing up in your political life on the right always knew that that was a priority in any election. And the Democrat mindset just, I don't even know if they've learned to this moment.
Yeah.
They'll boo-hoo and moan and groan, and will it be a part of the midterms? Will it be a part of 24 and the next, you know, in that open primary when Biden steps aside? I'll be interested to see.
Okay, so let's talk about some politics, some midterm politics. What is the most interesting midterm race that you are watching right now? There's a lot of choices here.
Yeah,
where should we start? Should we start with, I don't know, Ohio, Georgia, Missouri, Pennsylvania? Where do you want to start?
So I know there's so many. We have to get to all of them because there's primaries coming up and things are getting very exciting. Just around the corner in May, we're going to have the Pennsylvania primary, I believe the 17th, and then the Georgia primary is the 24th. I can't remember when Ohio is. It's supposed to be May 3, right? So yeah, it's really around the corner. Why don't we start with Pennsylvania? Because the interesting thing is that the lovely and talented and politically astute Mrs. Trump apparently favors Dr. Oz in the primary. And so while David McCormick is gunning for Trump's endorsement so that he can hit the sweet spot and be the establishment candidate and the Trump candidate, he was disappointed to learn that last weekend Trump was name-dropping Dr. Oz at his event and saying nice things about him. And so if Melania is that influential, that's going to get real interesting.
That is interesting. So let's go to Missouri, because I'm dying to get your take on this Eric Greitens story, which is just as sleazy as you could possibly imagine. I mean, Eric Greitens, the former governor of Missouri, one of the leading Senate candidates now. Eric Greitens was forced to resign as governor in disgrace after a previous sex scandal. Okay. And he's making a comeback. And apparently in the new Republican Party, he's got some traction. Yesterday, his ex-wife accuses him of abuse. She writes in this affidavit, prior to our divorce, during an argument in late April 2018, Eric knocked me down, confiscated my cell phone, wallet, and keys, so I was unable to call for help or extricate myself and our children from our home. She added that his behavior included physical violence toward our children, such as cuffing our then three-year-old son across the face at the dinner table in front of me and yanking him around by his hair. So A.B. Stoddard, is he going to stay in the race? Is he going to try to tough this one out? He ran to Steve Bannon's show, of course, and says that he's facing these domestic abuse allegations because of, wait for it, Mitch McConnell. So how does this play out? So I don't know what the rules are anymore. So
right, exactly. Yeah. So it's hard to say because he was ahead in the polls. And there's a very fun competition going on in the Show Me State between Ted Cruz, who's backing Attorney General Eric Schmidt, and Josh Hawley, who's backing Vicky Hartzler, a congresswoman. Mm. So, you know, the Mitch McConnell, formerly known as the establishment world, has been worried about Greitens for more than a year now, and he has led in the polls. Trump cooled on him, but then he started to warm to him again. Kimberly Guilfoyle, I believe, is working for Greitens. And recently, Greitens had an audience. I mean, he had a seating, a knee bending at Mar-a-Lago with Trump. And what's interesting about going on Bannon's show is it makes it sound like he's not going to drop out. And since he's the candidate most emphatic about voting against Mitch McConnell, it's the thing that keeps Trump close. And Trump likes it when you beat your wife.
Oh,
usually
geez.
That he doubles down and he says things like, well, he denied it very strongly. Remember those words?
Right.
We've heard them just a few times. He might even say he denied it very glowingly. So it could go one of two ways. Either people go to Trump and say he can't survive this, and we've done some internal polling in the field, and it is going to sink him and get out now, and then he doesn't endorse him, or this excites him and he endorses him and says, yes, it's true, the ex-wife was paid by Mitch McConnell to make up some stuff, or I don't know.
So again, on this question of, I don't know what the standards are. So Sean Parnell, who was the Trump endorsed candidate in Pennsylvania, and was leading in the polls, I think, he dropped out after allegations of spousal abuse. On the other hand, Herschel Walker, who I think is acknowledged, you know, violently attacking his wife, is still the still going to be the nominee in Georgia. So I don't know what this means in Missouri. I mean, again, you and I both remember like 5 minutes ago when something like this was an automatic disqualification. But that was before the Republican Party was run by a guy who bragged about grabbing women by the pussy. So I'm
right, you know, on. And standing by us, he defiantly backed Roy Moore.
Yeah,
it's really a mystery. I've been secretly before yesterday hoping that the endorsement for Greitens would come out any day from Trump, because that would make it so delicious. But now maybe people will talk him out of it the way they talked him out of all his Putin poetry that he was doing in public. Maybe, I don't know.
So I asked my colleague Jim Swift, who follows Missouri politics very closely, what he thought. I said, do you think that Greitens drops out because the pressure seems so intense on him to do that? And Swift doesn't think he's going to, because he says, you know, the comment from his lawyers, you know, suggests a political hit job, all of that stuff. But I think here's the key point that Jim made. He said, I think after his first failure and disgrace, he's out of shame.
Right.
So remember the thing about Eric Greitens is he's already been through this. He's had his time in the barrel. He already was shamed and disgraced, forced to resign as governor. Is he going to do it again? So Jim said he seems way more addicted to power than, say, Sean Parnell was, especially since he's had a taste of it, and Parnell has not. So I think that's interesting. I don't know these guys, but I think it's an interesting observation to understand that Greitens has already made it clear that he is shameless. Otherwise, he wouldn't be running for U.S. Senate, having been, you know, thoroughly disgraced and humiliated and discredited when he was governor.
Having bound up a woman in his basement and forced like photos and other things on her that I can't describe. This is part of the sickness, is that we learned through having Trump as president that people without shame are incredibly dangerous. And when you're crazy and you don't feel shame, which is what I think Eric Greitens, you know, illustrates here, well, you can't make sound judgments and you know, he could stay in the race and Lord only knows what he'd do with power again. It makes it clear that Sean Parnell on his own decided, like, I can't put my kids through this and I have some shame. It's just a difference, right?
Yeah, there is a difference there. Okay, so speaking of completely without shame, Ohio, which has become this incredible clown show, Josh Mandel, who looked like he was going to get into a fist fight with another candidate over the weekend. You saw that. It's just that campaign has been at a cartoon level for so long that it boggles the mind. How is that playing out? I mean, I guess that what's interesting about all of these races is that Republicans are well positioned to win. I mean, they could, given it's a midterm election, in Georgia, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Missouri, and yet there's a chance they could snatch defeat from the jaws of victory by nominating somebody who is thoroughly deplorable. Is Ohio one of those states?
Oh, no question, because I think Tim Ryan is the best candidate the Democrats could even ever hope for in a red state like Ohio. He's from Youngstown. He knows rural areas, rural voters, the Trump voter. He's speaking like a progressive often now to get out of the primary, even though he's pretty much uncontested. But he will have a good general election message. And I'm not saying he can win unless they nominate someone crazy, but it looks like they just might do that. So yeah, that's a threat in Ohio, because the Democrats don't have a social justice warrior or some, you know, Justice Democrat, you know, move on candidate going up against Josh Mandel if he's the nominee. I'm interested in the guy who's ahead, the self-funded guy who got the near fisticuffs with Mandel. He polls better than him. And so I'm wondering, it was interesting last night, there was another debate and J.D. Vance, who's, you know, really worried that the crazies aren't listening to him anymore. And he's like lost so much oxygen that.
Yeah. Dial up the crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Like a one-on-one top to, you know, these other two guys at the top of the polls are getting all the attention. Was asked last night, why did he put down President Trump in 2016? And he said, you know, he said stupid things at the time and he was stupid to say stupid things out loud, but he changed his mind on Trump because he reengaged with his faith, which I thought was really a beauty. About him circling back to the Lord and having three kids made him come back to Trump. He also was talking about how Josh Mandel just uses the Marines and his service as a political football. It's a pathetic lineup. And what I can't understand is why Jane Timken, who was the former state party chair and once a normal Republican who supported, you know, Kasich and Rubio and stuff, I can't understand why she has not been able to separate herself from the pack and find a way to distinguish herself. I think it's probably because she's wedded herself too much to Trump. All her advertisements talk about is, you know, how she's a whatever, America First, MAGA bot, Trumpkin, you know, candidate. And it's just a mess. It's a total mess. I guess the guy, Bernie Marino, the car guy, he dropped out, but it's hard to see where it goes. You know, if Vance drops out, does his crazy vote go to Mandel? I can't really quite figure it out, but I know it would worry Mitch McConnell because they have a viable candidate on the Democratic side.
Yeah, it makes my head hurt. I mean, Josh Mandel said yesterday that you know, it's the job of what the workplace, schools, government, everything to instill more faith. I mean, it's pure theocratic. What he actually means, who knows? I mean, this is the thing. I mean, does he actually know what he's talking about? I mean, which faith? Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Presbyterian. He's Jewish. I mean, does he want the workplace to instill what, reform, conservative, orthodox? I mean, what? I mean, yeah. And how? This is a certain incoherence. Speaking of which, just when you thought the Congress could not get any stupider, you notice that Sarah Palin is suggesting that she might run for Don Young's seat in Congress from Alaska.
What could be more delicious?
We don't need more material. I'm sorry, the pattern is... Normally, there was a time when I would go, just bring that on. That's red meat for us. This is more material. I feel that the pipeline is clogged, you know?
I felt the same way. But it is just sort of still an interesting plot line. I don't know. It'll be interesting also to see if there's anyone that would be an anti-Sarah Palin candidate in Alaska, right? There's that... the woman that Trump is backing against Murkowski in the Senate race, you know, has also said she would vote against Mitch McConnell. So it'll be interesting how much, you know, I guess Sarah Palin would have to say terrible things about the establishment, which she has in the past. But if this breaks up into different Republican camps, that will be fascinating.
All right. So you had a very interesting piece recently in Real Clear Politics about how these new voting laws, these new burdens passed by Republicans could actually backfire by threatening their own candidates in the midterms. Tell me how that works. And let's start with Texas.
Right. So because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, this has gone largely unnoticed that the March 1st primary in Texas, the first election after they passed these reforms in September, was a mess. And what you had was basically suppression of the votes from confusing new rules and restrictions that not only hampered the vote on the Democratic side, but the Republican side. So the fun statistics that the AP, the Associated Press, rounded up was that you had an initial rejection rate of 17% across 120 counties for mail-in ballots, which far surpasses any previous election. The rejected ballot rate from the 2020 election, for example, didn't even reach 1%. And while those numbers will go down, because some of them will be corrected, the final number is going to far exceed, like I said, anything in the past.
Huh.
You had in Parker County, where Trump won 4-1 in 2020, the ballot rejection rate was 23%. And in the five counties Trump won with the largest number of mail-in ballots, the combined rejection rate was 21%.
So now, they may be suppressing their own vote.
They're suppressing their own votes. And guess what? Elderly people like drop boxes and they want to vote by mail and they vote Republican. So that's a state that, you know, that Abbott is calling for audits and doing all this dumb stuff, even though Trump won it handily. Georgia is now debating their second round, Charlie. Remember last year they passed these things, which basically allow the state legislature to corrupt the count and steal the election. And they have candidates like Jody Heiss running against the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who's
likely to win, right? I mean, Jody Heiss is likely to win.
And then, you know, cook the books. So now they want to do another round, which they're hard at work on right now, of Republican-only new voter restrictions, which will really be a problem in Georgia, where there are no votes to spare. This is not Texas. This is a swing state that Biden won. And you have Kemp, the governor, who is, you know, target number one of Trump's, but is doing very well in his primary race against David Perdue, Trump's candidate, saying gently, look, we have good reforms. We passed this great new law. Everything's great. We don't need new voting laws. We don't need new bills. I don't know that he can actually go as far as vetoing it because that, you know, he wants to rock the boat. But it is crazy new stuff, Charlie, that allows the Georgia Bureau of Investigations jurisdictions to just launch investigations without a referral so that it can just work alongside the Secretary of State as its own kind of overseer of elections. There are crazy, crazy impediments that basically, without boring listeners with details, sets up a pretext for the state takeover of local elections. The reason is the first overhaul a year ago allowed this, that if too much mayhem, too many problems happen, we're going to have to allow the state to come in. And it's basically, that's what they're trying to grease, that they want the chaos.
Right.
Because any problems, right, become the pretext. And that's what's so scary. Now, while we're all talking, you know, occasionally, because it still hasn't been passed, about the reform of the Electoral Count Act, yes, that's important. But Republican legislatures in these places have seen to it that the count will be stopped before it gets to certification in the state and before it gets to Congress. They want to create enough of a narrative of, quote, fraud and problems in their state electoral processes that it can't be certified by the government.
So the chaos then is the pretext for them to overturn the election. So it's important to create a situation where you can do this. And I'm looking at the various things that they're doing in Georgia, you know, the language regarding poll observers requiring them to fairly observe election activities has been changed to meaningfully, perhaps inviting a more aggressive approach. You know? You quote the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, you know, saying that a lot of counties are already having enough of a problem recruiting poll workers without the threat of law enforcement investigations. Now, with that threat, could be more of a discouragement. So you may not have as many qualified, experienced poll workers there. This whole chain of custody procedures would treat elections as a crime scene. I mean, who needs this shit in your life? You know?
And Kemp knows this. Kemp knows it's BS, but he's going to try to inch his way to this primary where he is ahead of Perdue in the polls. Perdue's entire campaign, as you know, is based on all this stuff and conspiracy theories and the big lie. And he doesn't have any other disagreements with Kemp. Kemp is seen as a trusted conservative by voters in the state, and he's actually seen as the most trusted figure when it comes to elections, ironically, according to this new poll that I keep in that I have in the column. But yeah, none of this is needed. It's all an impediment to vote, and it's going to suppress their own voters.
Real men of political genius.
Yes.
A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We always enjoy it.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.